Guardian Unlimited.
It's a nationalisation, if you like, not in terms of the appropriation of the means, but it's making national what until then many Americans had regarded as a regional southern problem. It's so, yes, when they take it to D.C., they're saying, we've dealt with the police commissioner, you know, the Bull Connors of this world. We've dealt with the governors and the sheriffs and so on. But this is a national problem, and we're taking it to the place where power is. So we've come to talk truth to power. And interesting, because Washington, D.C. is a majority, and has been for, I think, for a very long time, if not always, a majority black town. And so the city's establishment is terrified. And they cancel the big ball game for that weekend. They cancel the leave for the officers. They clear a huge arena to put all of the arrested people in. They are anticipating not just a large demonstration, but a major physical conflict. You know, not really believing that King's nonviolent strategy will hold. And also being aware that while the nonviolent strategy has been pursued, there has also been a desire among civil rights activists to force a crisis. That's what happened 2 years earlier with the Freedom Rides. That's what happened in Birmingham, in Kelly Ingram Park. You force a crisis. You force power to confront you in your pursuit of your rights. You don't start violence. You don't get violent, but you force the state to use all the power in its means to contain you. And that's what they feared was going to happen in Washington.
Describe the brilliance, if you like. First of all, the strategic brilliance of the speech in terms of what he put in it and what he left out.
I mean, the strategic brilliance of the speech is that King spoke over the interests of just the South and spoke to the heart of what America believes itself to be and always has done. And so, you know, this dream, you know, in his I Have a Dream speech, this dream is rooted in the American dream. He says this at the Lincoln Monument. Lincoln, the man who won the Civil War and who is credited with freeing the slaves. He talks about the promissory note that Americans, that African Americans have, that they've been promised this, and this is what they've come to have, this promissory note. They've come to have this check cashed. So they want to know that America is going to be good on its promise. And he speaks to over the heads of the immediate demands of the civil rights workers, and he appeals to a very kind of basic humanistic desires, that my children can play with yours, that that we can sit and eat together. He asks for social equality. He doesn't ask for economic equality, not yet. He doesn't particularly even ask for political equality, just social equality. Let's have the same rights. In a way, what he's saying is, let's live up to our promise as Americans. So it's not a speech that he's not speaking to black people. He's speaking to Americans. And that's what gives the speech reach, if you like, for those white people who don't have the imagination to understand that a black person can be speaking to everyone. King says, this is about all of us. And there was a narrow window when someone could do that. Within 4 years, people, you know, the demonstrations were about black power, and white people were moving out of suburbs and moving into suburbs and out of cities, and we were in a completely different place.
Describe, was this an extemporized speech in its latter stages when he was getting to the dream part?
Well, one of the most interesting things about it, I Have a Dream, I mean, had it been up to King, had it been up to Kennedy, the speech would never have been delivered. Kennedy tried to stop the march because he felt it was going to, you know, be a mess for him and the Democratic Party and so on. But had it just been down to King, the speech probably wouldn't have been remembered either. That the "I Have a Dream" part was part of a riff that he had been working on and that he'd used several times before. And actually, he had used just a couple weeks earlier at a group of executives in Detroit, I think car executives in Detroit. He had used his "I Have a Dream" speech. Mahalia Jackson, who had sung earlier and who had heard this riff elsewhere, King, if you listen to the speech, he's winding down and he's telling people, so go back to where you came from and tell the people this and the other and so on. And Mahalia Jackson reaches forward and says, tell them about the dream. Tell them about the dream. And if you listen to the speech, you hear it's winding down and then boom. King comes up again for that final riff. And the other thing to note about it is it's a preacher's speech. It's the speech that has all the cadences and all the rhythm of a preacher. And that's what, if you've ever been, particularly in my mind, to an African-American Baptist service that can go on forever, then you will see the preacher kind of drawing you in, I'm leaving now, this is my last bit, you're just thinking, right, put my coat on, go back, get my Sunday lunch, and then whack, he's off again. And so this was the final riff. And without it, I wonder whether the demonstration would have been remembered in the same way that, you know, Woodstock is remembered. But ask anyone what was played at Woodstock, and they'd be struggling. I think the demonstration would always have been remembered, but I don't think the speech would have been.
So, I mean, just to make the point then, he was, perhaps the whole speech, was that the entire speech, basically, King operated as a preacher. He was ad-libbing. He didn't have a script in his hand.
No, he didn't have a script written down. He very rarely spoke from a written script. And it wouldn't be quite right to say that he was ad-libbing either, insofar as it was a collection. It was a collection of speeches that he had been given up and down the country for the last 8 years. It's a medley. And to that extent, all of his speeches were extemporized. And this one riff was not something that he had, by all accounts, not something that he had originally intended to do. But it was perfect for the moment. And it came, you know, straight off what had been a pretty good speech. But this is what made it memorable.
And it's also perfect for almost anybody anywhere who feels themselves downtrodden and oppressed in a way, isn't it? It's almost beyond any other speech I can think of. It endures beyond its specific context.
Yeah. It's a speech that is rooted in its time and place, but which is also universal in its appeal in terms of time and place, I believe. I've sat with... I mean, everybody has a dream, right? People have dreams. And while that dream may have been rooted in the American dream, the Americans aren't the only people that dream. And in the darkest days of people being oppressed, all they can do is dream. And so the notion that I have a dream, just that idea that, you know, I have a dream of something better, is a universal idea. I sat with a gypsy in rural Czech Republic and had him say, you know, what we need is a Martin Luther King. We have a dream, but we need a man, you know, who can make this happen. There's almost no oppressed group in the world that hasn't heard of this speech and that can't adapt it to the conditions that they're in. That's the power of it. The power of it is that they can do that, and that you would have to be a particular kind of despot in order to say, I don't really care about your dream. I'm in the business of crushing dreams. It's a powerful demand that is made in a very, very subtle way.
Guardian Unlimited.